Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of September. Jonathan Kozol has been written extremely moving and important books about the poor among us for many years. Some of you will remember reading Death at an Early Age, his first nonfiction book, which was about his time as a teacher in the Boston public schools. He's gone on to write Rachel and Her Children, Homeless Families in America, Savage Inequalities, Children in America's Schools, Amazing Grace, The Lives of Children and the Conscience of a Nation, Ordinary Resurrections, Children and the Years of Hope, and The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. He has a new book, which he starts on Christmas Eve of 1985, and he starts the book and describes the people at the Martinique Hotel, one of the largest homeless shelters with 1,400 children and 400 parents, and he visited the families and became, over the course of 25 years, pretty close to many of them. He had never seen destitution like this in America before. His book is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America, and he has a great deal to say about poverty and resilience in the education system in this country, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we welcome your calls during this hour for Jonathan. Hello, Jonathan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I remember interviewing you for the WEA convention in Milwaukee many, many years ago. And when I said you were going to be on the air, it's so many people have said to me, oh, we can't wait to listen to him. So
great. By the way, I'm going to be back there with you in Milwaukee very short time from now. Not this Saturday, but next Saturday, the 29th.
Yes, at 4 p.m., Goldemeyer Library, UWM
right,
campus.
Hosted by the by a very interesting magazine called Rethinking Schools.
Mm-hmm.
And also by the Milwaukee Teachers Association.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But I'm right now I'm speaking to you from Boston.
Well, thank you for speaking to us. We were talking last hour about politics, and we do so much of that. And a constant theme for me on this program is who's talking about the poor among us. And after reading your book, I realized nobody's talking about the kind of people that you write about, the utter, complete poverty that these people are living in homeless shelters, and it's probably gotten even worse over the past 10 years in this country. These people, you know, there are a handful of people who write about poverty in this country, and you're one of them. Otherwise, who even talks about it, Jonathan?
Well, not too many except the poor themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I might say Fire in the Ashes, my new book, it starts in a homeless shelter in Manhattan, but in a sense, that's just the prelude to the book. What happened is that, this was one of those huge homeless shelters. There were 1,600 children and parents packed into one building. But after I wrote about that hotel in a book called Rachel and Her Children, and after those hotels got a great deal of publicity, the city shut them down at the very end of the 1880s. By 1990, they were all shut down, and almost all the families that I knew were shipped en masse into the very poorest neighborhood of the South Bronx. South Bronx itself, the poorest congressional district in the nation. And the story really begins there, where I followed these families and then met lots of other families and their children. And over the course of the 1990s, I wrote three books about what their childhood was like. Then about 4 or 5 years ago, people started asking me, what happened to them since then?
Mm-hmm.
Have you kept in touch with them? How many have survived? How many didn't? So that was the impetus to go back and walk the same streets in the South Bronx again and find the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them never did recover, I'm sorry to say, from the battering they underwent in their early years. Three of them are no longer alive. In fact, one little boy whom I knew when he was only 9 years old went on into an adolescence that was tormented. He never recovered and ended up by taking his own life. He shot himself in the head finally with a shotgun. Others died as well, all by their own hands.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mourned with their mothers, and I mourn for them still. But I guess the exciting part of the new book is that a huge number of the kids battled back quite courageously, and with their own courage and guts, but also with the very well-timed intervention of grown-ups who intervened aggressively on their behalf. An awful lot of these kids have won triumphant victories.
Is it, you mentioned the young boy who committed suicide, and that's such a moving story. The family had moved to Montana, and this great generosity on the part of the church and helped them with housing and jobs, et cetera, but what were tormenting him in New York continued to torment him. Is it fair to say, or would this be a stretch, that it was much more difficult for the boys than for the girls?
Yes, that's an important theme in the early part of the book. I'm not sure why this is so, but the highest casualties were among the boys. One reason I suspect is that the boys, you know, even when they were homeless, they were the ones who had to go out in the street and panhandle to bring in money to buy food. And they were the ones also, it just turns out all the boys I described were getting into their preteen years, or they were already teenagers at the time they were homeless. And they were more cognizant of the squalor that surrounded them. They were old enough to see the drugs, to see, you know, to see the humiliation of their families. Their sisters, in all these cases, happened to be younger, and they were somehow protected. I mean, even if they were the same age, they were more protected because their mothers kept them in their kept them under closer watch. But the boys, really, you know, you couldn't lock them in the room, couldn't keep them there. So the little boys were the ones who seemed to be most traumatized. Amongst the children who survived most dramatically, well, some were boys, but in general, the girls were more successful.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more, Jonathan, about the schools, the really terrible schools that many of these young people went to. And sometimes there were interventions, so they went to private schools or to boarding schools or to better schools. But the inequality of the school experience is quite striking.
Well, a good example would be a little girl called Pineapple.
Pineapple.
And she's an adorable little girl, and I met her when I walked into her kindergarten class, actually, when she was 6 years old. And I mean, on the positive side, she was absolutely, absolutely rambunctious, delightful, very funny little girl, charming. She was a little on the plumpish side. She had beaded cornrows hanging down over her eyes. She was a very, very bossy little girl. Started giving me instructions from the time we met. By the time she was 8 years old, she was she decided my social life wasn't interesting enough and tried to fix me up with her teacher. When she was 9, she started scolding me because she didn't like the suit I wore, which was the clothes I wore. I had a suit that had been very nice once, but it was rather worn and shabby, and she sat me down once and said, "Jonathan, I'd like you to look more respectable." No. But her school was just a nightmare. It was a physically disgusting place. It was ugly physically. The basement cafeteria was, it was medieval. It was squalid, and it smelled terrible. Mm. I know because she made me go down there with her once and eat lunch. Principal was horrified. The principal of the school said, "Oh no, Mr. Kozo, we have a lovely catered lunch for you in my office." And a little pineapple said, "He's coming with me." Mm. And so I saw the conditions they lived under, and the conditions that surrounded them at school, and I believed then, and I believe to this day, that the aesthetics of schooling are terribly important. I think that beautiful settings tell children how much we value them, and I think ugly settings tell them that they don't matter a whole lot in the eyes of their society. The school had huge class size, maybe 32, 34. I think Pineapple had 36 in 1 year. And as a result, teachers kept quitting. It was an almost impossible job. Pineapple had 7 different teachers in her 3rd and 4th grade year. The school tried to compensate for this by, they tried to make up for huge classes and high turnover of teachers by a very rigid uniformity in methods of instruction. Mm-hmm. The idea essentially was, that the teachers might keep quitting, but there would be continuity in the lessons they taught. And there was a heavy emphasis on drilling for examinations. All these were precursors of what we see now in the federal law, No Child Left Behind. There's an awful lot of what we call drill and grill instruction. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work. Pineapple learned absolutely nothing at that school. I mean, I didn't have any books that were fun to read. All those beautiful children's classics that suburban kids generally get to enjoy, lovely books like, I don't know, Kathleen, if you know the works of Eric Carle. Are you familiar with that name?
Give me a title, maybe I will.
Oh, The Very Hungry Caterpillar.
Yes, yes, of course.
The Grouchy Ladybug.
Yes.
These aren't just sweet stories for children. They're beautiful books. They're with lovely artwork in them. They didn't have anything like that. They just had this sort of programmed system which was geared to exams. And but it didn't work then, and it didn't work. No Child Left Behind didn't work either. By the time Pineapple was in 5th grade, I sat down with her finally, and see, until then, I thought she was so good at conversation. Her verbal skills were so good that it never occurred to me that she wasn't learning how to transfer this into written words. I finally sat down with her in fifth grade, and I found she could barely write a sentence longer than five words. And she was a smart and savvy little girl. So she had been essentially artificially retarded by the classic separate and unequal school that she attended. There wasn't a single white child in the school, and still the case today. Now, in Pineapple's case, you know, she was lucky. A good priest in the neighborhood, an Episcopal priest, a woman priest, who was very savvy and well-connected, an unusual priest who had gone to Harvard and been a lawyer for a time and was very knowledgeable before she became a priest. She, and interesting, she was unflaggingly loyal to public education, as I am, but she did finally what any wealthy parent would have done. She pulled Pineapple out of the schools in the South Bronx, and using her connections from college, she knew a lot of influential people, she was able to get Pineapple into a terrific prep school for rich children. And suddenly, now, with 15 children in her class instead of 36, and teachers who weren't terrorized by drilling for exams but could actually listen to Pineapple and enjoy her personality, her love of learning just exploded, and she did very well at that school. And then in ninth grade, she won a scholarship to a wonderful boarding school up in New England, in Rhode Island, as it happened. It happened to be a racially mixed school, too. As she told me later, she said, 10th grade was my breakthrough year. I'm quoting her now. She said, from that point on, I knew that I could do it, that I could go to college. And she did. In fact, just a few days ago, she entered her senior year of college. And, you know, even better from my point of view, even a greater triumph, I think, is not just that she graduated, but she graduated as not simply as a successful kid from the ghetto who now can, you know, go out and earn a lot of money, but she graduated with a high sense of moral responsibility. She just told me that she's planning to go back for another year at college after she graduates in order to get certified to teach in public school.
Oh, that's great.
She wants to go back to the South Bronx. She said, you know, to pass the torch along, she said. That's what I decided I should do. Pass it on, she said. Do it for the ones I left behind. So, you know, I'm terribly proud of her. And I, especially because of her sense of responsibility to her own community. But I always caution people that if there's any lesson here, it's not that we should celebrate exceptionality of opportunity, because she was very lucky. She was a little charmer and won the attention of her priest. The lesson here is that the public schools themselves should have the same good resources, small class size, and the same respected and unintimidated teachers as the school that saved Pineapple's soul. You shouldn't have to be a little charmer
right,
to get a first grade education in America. That's sort of the point of the book.
Yes, and what about the importance of schools in being able, when you write about the incredible poverty and the people shooting up and people dying of heroin overdoses, the violence in many of the neighborhoods where these young people live, can a really beautiful school with wonderful teachers give people who have been left behind the change they need in their lives to become more like pineapple, or are those odds kind of overwhelming, Jonathan?
Well, in a few cases, they are overwhelming, as evidenced by the young man whose family was able to move out to Montana, and where they had relatively good schools, but by then he was so traumatized and so tormented that nothing could save him. But in general, as a general rule, here's my own belief. People say to me all the time, Jonathan, with so many other obstacles facing them, bad housing, terrible slum housing, frequently a lack of good medical care in poor neighborhoods, or all the other factors that work against them, do schools really matter that much? And I answer, yes, they do, because marvelous schools with ample resources and really small classes where the teacher can pay attention to each child, where it's not, where the teacher isn't feeling like embattled by trying to keep 35 kids under control, but where the teacher's relaxed and the teacher can, sit down with one child for a half hour while the rest of the class is working on a project of some sort. The teacher who can give a lot of thought to what that child needs. Those kinds of schools really do work miracles with kids. And I believe to this day that the key lever of escape, I'm mixing my metaphors, Kathleen. maybe I could word it this way. The best avenue of escape from the depths of poverty in America remains the public education system, if it's good and if it's well-funded and if the schools that serve the poorest kids have the same terrific resources as the kids as the schools that serve the privileged.
Jonathan Kozol is our guest. We'll welcome phone calls for him. His latest book is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. He's the author of a number of very important books. I'm sure you're familiar with many of them. Death at an Early Age, Savage Inequalities, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This particular book, people have asked him what happened to the young children that you met back in 1985, and he has kept in touch with these people. Some of the stories are tragic. Some of the young people are no longer around. They have died from suicide, from drug overdoses. Others are a source of inspiration for all of us, and the book looks at how both ends happened. So we welcome your phone calls, and we'll start taking them momentarily. He will be in Milwaukee at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Goldemeyer Library on September 29th, which is a week from Saturday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jonathan Kozol is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Fire in the Ashes is his latest book. Mark in Oconomowoc is our first caller, Jonathan. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I thought one of the most effective, I'd like to talk about politics and poverty. I thought one of the most effective speakers at the Democratic Convention was Sister Simone Campbell, who is the leader of Nuns on the Bus, who is going around criticizing the Ryan budget for the heavy hit it takes on people in poverty. I could be wrong, but it seems to me that the Republican Party has become kind of the party of Ayn Rand, that if you're poor, you're poor not because of circumstances, but because of choice. And I just don't understand that.
Well, that's a, this is Jonathan now. That's a very common inclination of many people, and, you know, not just Republicans, but a lot of people will tell me, you know, people who presumably are well-educated, some of my Harvard classmates will, you know, who live in New York, wealthy neighborhoods, will say to me, you know, they'll say, isn't the real point that these poor people have made bad choices, that these kids have made bad choices? And I tend to bristle at that argument. I tend to get very angry at that argument because, yeah, of course, poor kids just like wealthy kids do sometimes make bad choices, but the choices that are most decisive in their lives are the choices they never got to make for themselves. And those are choices, you know, that are made by society or by government. One such choice is that our society has refused to provide good, rich, comprehensive preschool for these children. So we blame their parents. We say, well, their parents won't help them to learn to read and write when they're little babies, which in itself is unfair because most of their parents went to the same miserable schools that they go to. So their parents' skills are very poor. Or they'll, you know, say these kids just, you know, didn't, they just don't want to learn, something like that. The choices that matter are those that our society has made. We have decided without admitting it because it's too embarrassing, but we have essentially decided that that it's okay to put our poorest kids, especially minority kids, into schools in which they never have a chance to mix with children of the middle class. Or children of other races, so they're totally isolated. We have decided that it's okay to shortchange them financially. That's okay for them to have large classes, and it's okay for them to depend on skimpy resources, libraries that, you know, would be considered embarrassing in any good suburban district. And as I said in the start, it's okay to rob them of early childhood education, which is crucial. So, you know, you could say, you know, is it the child's fault? You know, did this little girl make a bad decision? Well, this little girl never made any decision about denying herself preschool. That was a decision made by the powers that be, the people who don't want to tax themselves enough to pay for necessities like that for poor children. You know, I have friends in New York, as I said before, presumably well-educated people, who will look me right in the eyes and say, Jonathan, yeah, it's a shame that Pineapple had 36 children in her class, but, you know, does class size really matter all that much for those kinds of children? If they just did their job, if the teachers did the work we pay them for, they love to scapegoat teachers. And they have the nerve to say that to me. They say, you know, does class size really matter? And I always ask them where their kids go to school.
Right.
And typically their kids go to school, you know, in schools that have 15 or 16 children in a class, in either affluent suburban public schools or else, you know, terrific private schools. And, you know, I'll say, you know, I try to be polite, but I'll say, I don't know, small class size seems to do the job for your children, doesn't it? And there's something, I would call it a sort of organized hypocrisy, because I don't think the individuals are aware of the fact that they're applying a double standard, that for their children, and ironically for their children who need it least, because they have, because they do have well-educated parents, those kids also get the absolutely optimal conditions in school. And the kids who need it most, the poorest kids, get the worst. In New York at the present moment, because my book takes place in New York City, the inequalities are even greater than most other places, because even within the borders of New York City, parents in the richest neighborhoods are raising huge amounts of private money through fundraising parties and such to add to the public funds their neighborhood schools receive. And that, and the New York Times refers to these parent groups as the million-dollar PTAs, because they're raising typically $1 million a year.
Goodness.
To add to the budget that all the other schools have to depend upon. And so, you know, and with that money, what do? They build beautiful libraries. They put in art studios, wonderful music programs. They hire extra teachers to lower class size. And to me, this, you know, this is like the end of any pretense of a meritocracy in our society. It represents the narrowing of civic virtue to the smallest possible parameters.
Mark, thank you very much for the call. We need to go to other callers. Jennifer in Manitowoc is next. Jonathan. Hi, Jennifer. Jennifer?
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm Jennifer from Manitowoc, and I just want to thank you, Jonathan, for all of your dedication and hard work these many years. I do have one question. In Savage Inequalities, you talked a lot about the amount spent per child in the inner city versus the suburb, and I'm wondering if you have some updated quotes I can use when I have to argue points with others.
Yes, the inequalities persist all over the nation. In fact, in the past couple of years since the recession, it's gotten worse, because states have been tightening their budgets, and one of the first results is lay off school teachers, tighten up school budgets, no money on frills, and frills include things that I would not consider frills, like like arts and music and anything, but basically anything that can't be tested on a standardized exam is considered a frill. So they're cutting all that out. But what happens is the wealthy suburban schools can simply raise their local property tax. And since their homes are worth an awful lot of money, say they're a suburb where there are suburbs like this all over the country where houses cost as much as $1 million or $4 million, very tiny property tax pulls in a huge amount of money. And of course, you can't do that in a poor community, because the housing doesn't have that value. We have a built-in system in America that guarantees a kind of, you know, hereditary privilege in the public system, and it shouldn't be that way. I mean, if you want to rig the game for your child, all right, spend $100,000 of your own money and send both your kids off to an expensive prep school. But if you're going to stay in the public system, I think the struggle should not be put extra money into my school, but should be a concerted community-wide effort to demand adequate funds for all the children in that district.
Well, Jonathan, how do you make that happen?
Well, there really aren't too many options. And the best way to get, the only way you can ever get more money into our public schools is by some form of taxation. The question is, where's it going to come from? My own belief, and this is, what's happening now is, instead of taxation that's well targeted to go to the kids who need it most, what we're doing is simply scapegoating the teachers who work in these poor schools and say, it's their fault. They're no good. Or you blame them because they're members of a union. Or you blame them, I don't know, you blame them for some reason or other. A lot of teachers I know who refuse to drill kids for exams are getting threatened and penalized and because it just goes against their principles to ignore all the cultural aspects of education and drill kids for tests. So we're blaming the teachers. They're the scapegoats for all the sins of our society. If we wanted, if I were president of the United States, one thing I'd do right away would be to take all those billions of dollars that are presently going to enormous multinational testing corporations, huge testing companies that not only prepare these standardized exams, but also run private test prep institutions to enable wealthy people to score high on the tests, and then they also control the institutions that score the tests. I take all those billions of dollars that our government is now throwing at the testing corporations, and I would redirect that money into universal preschool for every low-income child starting at the age of 2.5, and I would pour the rest of that money into the elementary grades in order, at very least, to reduce the size of classes by half, so that a teacher who's doing a pretty good job with 36 kids could do a spectacular job with 18. Mm. And that's what I would do if I were president. And if President Obama ever asked my opinion, that's what I would tell him he ought to do. I'd say, you ought to talk about this more. You should be talking about the inequalities. You should be talking about the fact that we still have a virtually apartheid schooling system for minority kids. Little Pineapple in my book, she's not so little anymore. She's a very savvy college student now. I once said to her, because she's gotten more political now that she's grown up, I once said to her, don't you think something will change now? And she knew where I was going. She said, now that we have an African-American president, you mean? And I said, yes. And she said, nope, I don't think anything's going to change, because if he wanted to, he would already have taken steps to give our kids the same privileges that wealthy kids receive. Mm-hmm. He hasn't. I'm going to vote for him again, and I have no choice, because I'm a lifelong Democrat. I can still remember my mother crying the night that Franklin Roosevelt died.
Oh, do you?
If I didn't vote for him, my mother, who passed away just recently at the age of 102.
Oh, my goodness, Jonathan. Remarkable.
My mother, I swear, would come back from the grave and punish me. And I respect him, but I'm very disappointed that he has not spoken out about any of these elemental issues. I just don't understand how a man who's so intelligent could ignore such obvious things as the denial of preschool to our poorest children. I just can't figure that out.
What did you make of the teacher strike in Chicago, Jonathan?
I supported the strike right from the start, and I was thinking all along, how long? I mean, long before there was any talk of a strike there, I was just thinking, how long are those teachers going to be able to put up with the abusive way they're treated by the mayor? I mean, he really is kind of contemptuous of teachers. And he obviously, he gave indications all along that what he'd really like to do is move towards privatization of the schools, you know, like have increasing numbers of private corporations coming in, profit-making corporations coming in and running semi-private charter schools, which, you know, some of the charter schools are good and some aren't, but that's, in a sense, it represents the front edge of the general assault upon the whole ideal of universal public education in America. And I think the teachers were justified. I mean, Chicago, for example, spends about $13,000 per pupil. You go up to exclusive New Trier High School, which is the top high school in the suburbs of Chicago, and one of the top high schools in America, and they're spending $20,000 a year. It just ain't fair. It's not the way it ought to be. People say, well, how would you change that? If I ever had the power, I would say, in the long run, it's the obligation of the federal government to guarantee that no matter what the economic condition might be in any given state at any particular moment, when industry shut down, for example, in some poor city, and there's no tax base any longer, that's the federal government has an absolute obligation to guarantee that every kid in America gets a high level of public education. And I say that in part because we don't go to school to be the citizens of Wisconsin or New York or Massachusetts. We go to, you know, we don't fly the flag of Massachusetts in the classroom. We fly the Stars and Stripes.
Jonathan Kozol, our guest. His latest book, Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. And the email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jonathan Kozol, our guest. Greg in Eau Claire. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you very much for this guest. Thank you, Jonathan, for the work that you're doing. When I was a kid, I was a ward of the state of Illinois in Chicago of DCFS, Department of Children and Family Services, and I experienced a lot of abject poverty and the ravages of abject poverty. And, you know, it is as true as it was then as it is today, even more so. The problem with generational poverty is so deep in America, and nobody looks at it. And now with this new form of poverty that's, you know, growing, other than generational poverty, that's affecting, you know, other, you know, more people. People are now taking a look at, but they were blind to the generational poverty of the hyper-segregated areas in large cities, and you know, in impoverished areas. I was fortunate. I was, by my white privilege, I was able to go to a foster home in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, and it was because of my race, because I was white. And I highly doubt that the children that were in the institutions that I were in back then got the same deal. And I saw, like I said, the ravages of generational poverty, and they just pretty much warehouse the children. As far as education goes, there was literally no education in any of the institutions that I went to. If there was anything, it didn't register to the kids that were there. And, you know, it was, they're juveniles, they're in a juvenile system, and it's just like they hop into the adult system of incarceration. And so that's, you know, just what I wanted to say that.
Jonathan.
Well, you know, everything I'm saying, of course, applies to poor white kids as well as minority kids. But I agree with you that we always have our white privilege. I'm saying our because I'm a white man, and it does make a difference. The fact of the matter is that not only our schools, but you know all the other services that children badly need are gruesomely underfunded in this country. And you know, if we were a third world country, you could say, all right, we have no choice. But it's an embarrassment that the richest nation in the world and the nation that wants to hold itself out as a beacon of democracy to the rest of the world betrays its own principles at home in such a blatant way. And to me, you know, the most frightening thing right now is not just the assault upon teachers, just the indignities imposed on really good teachers that I know, especially the most creative teachers, many of whom, by the way, are getting out of public education because they can't stand this testing mania that's taken control of the schools. This assault upon teachers is, as I said before, is simply a reflection of a larger assault upon the whole idea, the whole Jeffersonian legacy of public education that serves all our children. This corporate assault upon the public schools is devastating, and that's what I believe we need to fight with all the sense of ethics that we have.
Greg, thanks for the call. Pete in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. Joy, let me get off this.
That's a good idea, Pete.
How's that?
There we go.
Okay. Jonathan for president. I have heard all I need to hear.
Thank you.
My God, I am 6 feet tall, and I feel like a raw nerve that's just been dipped in boiling water. You hit. Oh, when I was a little kid in a public school back in the 50s, I was third, fourth grade, 9 years old. I looked around my school with the bare tile floor, and the janitor chewing tobacco out there, sweeping the floors in between classes, and just a plain brick building, plain wooden desks. I knew that the government paid for that school, and I knew that they didn't have to waste a bunch of money putting fancy trim and shutters on the windows and carpet on the floor to impress me, because they gave me a wonderful teacher that cared in a class of about 25 kids. It wasn't a small class. But it was a rural
25 is good.
Yeah.
25
is good. I'm sorry?
25 is not a bad class size.
But I understood even then that we weren't there for the frills. You know, we didn't have organized teams or anything, even in middle school. If you wanted to play football or baseball or something, you had to wait until you got to high school. But we had, you know, big recess, and we had ball fields and blah, 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 all that stuff. But when I was 11, I got a chance to tour with my four-year older sister, who she would be like 15 or 16 in high school at that time, a new suburban high school that had been made. It was fully carpeted from one end to the other, science labs that looked like the University of Notre Dame, and it just absolutely spun my pea-sized little brain at that age out of control.
We have about 30 seconds left, Jonathan. Your response.
I would like to say simply that apart from all the other inequalities, the physical setting of the school, the aesthetics of the school matter tremendously. And one of the things that saved Pineapple, and it's a very important factor in my book, In Fire in the Ashes, is the fact that she was able to transfer into a school where she was surrounded by beauty, by attractive setting that told her, "You matter to us a lot. We're gonna include you in all the blessings of this wealthy nation."
Thank you, Jonathan, so much. Jonathan Kozol, the book is Fire in the Ashes, 25 Years Among the Poorest Children in America. Jonathan will be in Milwaukee at UW-Milwaukee Goldemeyer Library Saturday, September 29 at 4 o'clock for you to carry on the conversation. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program. A reminder, today would have been Frank Zeidler's 100th birthday. I'll be moderating the Frank Zeidler lecture tonight. His daughter, who was the mayor of Williamsburg, is going to be speaking, Jean Zeidler. It's at the Central Library downtown, Centennial Hall. It's free, and it should be a great evening. Thanks, everybody, for listening.